These questions are what drive us, and we're so interested in exploring the natural world. For me, like, the mysteries that the past holds are so intriguing. And every time we can, you know, uncover evidence or come, like, make a conclusion that lets us learn a little more about the collective ancestry of all people, that's awesome.
You are listening to the Down the Wormhole podcast, exploring the strange and fascinating relationship between science and religion. This week, our hosts are
Ian Benz, associate professor of elementary science education at UNC Charlotte. And I will butcher the name, but I think one of my favorite bridges is the one in Louisiana that goes over Lake Pontchartrain. It's like 7 miles long. That's a really interesting bridge. I mean, when you get on that thing, you are on that thing.
Well, I'm Zach Jackson, UCC pastor in Reading, Pennsylvania, and my favorite bridge is the Ben Franklin Bridge that goes into Philadelphia.
Our guest today is a paleoanthropologist at the Smithsonian's National Museum of Natural History, whose research centers on the evolution of human diet and focus on meat eating, but has included topics as diverse as human cannibalism and chimpanzee carnivory. She's done fieldwork in Kenya, Tanzania, South Africa, and Indonesia, and has been supported in her research by the Fulbright-Hays Program, the Leakey Foundation, the National Geographic Society, the National Science Foundation, Rutgers University, the Society for American Archaeology, Smithsonian Institution, and the Wenner-Gren, using my German there. Her favorite field moments include falling asleep in a tent in the Serengeti in Tanzania while listening to the distant whoops of hyenas, watching a pride of lions eat a zebra carcass on the Kenyan equator, and discovering fossil bones that were last touched, butchered, and eaten by one of her 1.5 million year old ancestors. Since she joined the Smithsonian in 2005, she's helped put together the Hall of Human Origins, which is, side note, an amazing exhibit, by the way. In addition to continuing her active field, laboratory, and experimental research programs, she also leads the Human Origins Program's education outreach efforts, which includes managing the Human Origins Program's public programs, website content, social media, and exhibition volunteer training. She's more recently developed a research program in evolution education science communication. She has a BA from Bryn Mawr College, where she created her own major called Evolutionary Studies, which is pretty cool. MA and PhD in Anthropology from Rutgers University. And she is an Associate Research Professor of Anthropology in the Center for the Advanced Study of Human Paleobiology at the George Washington University. So today we want to welcome Brianna Pobiner.
Thank you. I didn't realize you were going to read the whole bio, but...
Well, because I loved it.
It's so impressive when you put it together like that.
I know. I, you know, you had said to cut out some stuff if I wanted to, but as I kept reading through it, I said, no, this stuff is so cool. So I'm not cutting anything. So we asked you to come today because we're just now starting our series on human origins. And I think it'd be good for me maybe to let people know how you and I actually met. I'm trying to remember when it was. It was at a conference, an ASTE conference. That's one of our science education conferences. Maybe 4 or 5 years ago now?
I think so. That's right. In the last few years. Yeah.
Yeah. And we just met because a colleague, a mutual friend of ours, brought us together. I guess he had invited you to...
That's right. We were doing a round table discussion. So I think we met doing that.
Yeah.
Maybe. Yeah.
And then we just started kind of realizing that it was funny. That was when we kind of realized that at these conferences, there's like a group of us at these science ed conferences who kind of follow each other around to support each other whenever we do anything about evolution education. And Brianna was part of that, what became like our groupies. And so we just would all just kind of go to each session and still be the same people.
That's true.
And then we just slowly started getting to know each other a little bit better. And most recently, when I was in Alexandria for a few weeks at the Virginia Theological Seminary, I reached out and you kindly invited me to come and hang out in Smithsonian for a little while. And I got to go up to your office and just see some really cool stuff. So I totally geeked out that day.
That was a lot of fun. I enjoyed chatting with you.
Yeah, it was so much fun. But it was neat to kind of go through that exhibit again the Human Origins exhibit that you played a big role in, and to see some of the stuff that you contributed to, especially the video. And so I think what I would love to kind of talk about first is, if you remember what video I'm talking about.
Is this the one where I'm eating a termite?
I think, is that the one also too, where you're helping people, they like select things and then you...
Yes.
They guess where it is. Yeah, maybe. So if you can kind of talk a little bit about your background and kind of the exhibit itself and how you got into all of that.
Sure. So as you mentioned, I'm a paleoanthropologist. So my academic training is largely in anthropology. And as I was finishing up my PhD research, I had a chance conversation with the director of the Human Origins Program at the museum, Rick Potts. We had known each other for several years because we both do research in Kenya and ask similar research questions. And he asked me if I was looking for a potential postdoc opportunity. I was just finishing my PhD research, so I knew I still needed some time to write my dissertation, but I was really intrigued. And he said he was looking for somebody to come work with him at the Smithsonian to do three things. One was to help put together the Hall of Human Origins. And I had no experience with exhibits, but I thought that was a really intriguing opportunity. The second was to help run his archaeological excavations at a site called Alorga Sile in southern Kenya, because he had not finished doing the fundraising for the exhibit and knew that he might have to do something like leave his fieldwork in the middle of the field season. I had spent every summer as a graduate student helping to teach on a summer study abroad program in northern Kenya, teaching undergrads archaeology, so I could run an excavation. That was no problem. And the third thing was, he was looking for someone to study the fossils coming out of the oldest layers of excavation at Alorga Sile. And that was such a great natural postdoc project to follow on the research that I was doing for my dissertation on some older sites from Kenya and Tanzania. So I immediately said, this sounds fantastic. We both went back home to the States. I went down to DC to meet with Rick. And he said, I want you to seriously consider this, because if you come to help put together the exhibit, I'm going to ask you not to leave in the middle of the process, to go get an academic teaching job or something. And so, you know, I still said yes immediately. And he said, please go home and think about it. And I did. And I still said yes. So ironically, in graduate school, I didn't have training for anything other than doing research and going into academia. But I got really interested during the process of putting together the Hall of Human Origins. So I was on the content team, looking up all the information, working with the designers and the writer to help put the exhibit plan together. But I got really interested in public engagement with science. And so my permanent position at the Smithsonian now, it straddles continuing to do my research on the evolution of human diet, but also doing a lot of different education and outreach activities, as some of which you outlined, Ian. So that's my story of how I got where I am.
Mm. What's the most interesting thing in your office?
Oh, good question. The most interesting thing in my office, well, one of the most visually appealing things maybe in my office is a cast of a saber-tooth skull, which is sitting on a shelf. And so, it's something that you don't see every day for sure.
Right.
I'm really interested in saber-tooth. So the part of the evolution of human diet that really intrigues me is when early humans first started eating meat from large animals. And so when they were doing that, it's very likely that they were actually scavenging leftovers from predator kills. And so I've done some work in the modern world of figuring out, well, what's left over if a lion eats a zebra? Is there anything worth scavenging? But what we can't do is observe extinct creatures like saber-toothed cats. So I think it's, paleoanthropologists and paleontologists have a tricky job of trying to figure out, well, how do we know what it looks like when saber-toothed cats eat something? How can we figure out if early humans scavenged from them?
How can we tell how similar like a Siberian tiger would be to a saber-toothed tiger?
Yeah, that's a great question. And so there's a couple of ways. One is that you can find the living relative that has the most similar jaws and teeth and kind of skull shape and say, well, if this living, let's say it's, you know, a cheetah, which is much smaller, but has really sharp teeth like a saber-toothed cat. And, you know, I'm using saber-toothed cat as kind of a bucket. There are a whole different, there's a lot of different kinds of saber-toothed cats. So maybe when cheetahs chew on small animal bones, it will be similar to what saber-toothed cats, the damage they do on large animal bones. The other thing we can do is one thing I'm doing now with a colleague of mine, Jennifer Parkinson at University of San Diego. We can go to a fossil assemblage that we think was created by saber-toothed cats and actually look at the fossils in that assemblage of the animals that those cats chewed on and see what that looks like. So you'll have to stay tuned because we're still doing that work right now.
So I have heard it said or hypothesized that human development, Homo sapiens development, the development of our giant brains and all of that is directly correlated to when we tamed fire and started cooking meat and had easier access to calories. Is there merit to that?
I think there is some potential merit to that. So the what, you know, there is a hypothesis called the expensive tissue hypothesis. So our brains are really energetically expensive. They are 2% of our body weight, take up 20% of our energy at rest. So why do humans have such, we have enormously outsized brains for our body size. And the idea, the hypothesis is that, well, the way to evolutionarily develop large brains is you have to reduce some other expensive tissue in your body. Our gut tissue is also very expensive. So hypothesis, when early humans started eating meat, because it's a really good concentrated source of calories and fat and other things, guts shrank and brains expanded. The timing of meat eating and brain expansion doesn't line up very well. Meat eating goes back to probably somewhere between 2.5 to 3 million years ago. But the biggest increase in brain size in our evolutionary history, compared to our body size, which both increased kind of in tandem for a while, started at 1 million years ago. And as you mentioned, right now, what we have the earliest, I think, solid evidence for 1 million years ago is cooking. So it is very likely, because cooking breaks down food, lets us eat things that would otherwise be poisonous. It breaks food down both chemically and physically. That may have something to do with the evolution of our large brains.
I did not know that. There's a lot of things that you talk about that I don't know. I'm just all over the place.
That's why she's leading today.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm curious, Brianna, we brought you on here to talk about human origins, but we also, based on, you know, our friendship and getting to know you, have learned a lot about your efforts, as you said too, and as I read at the end, you don't have any training, formal training and education and communication, but that's something that you've become really passionate about and interested in. And, you know, you published a paper several, what was it, 2017, I guess?
2016. It's kind of 2016. A new paper about evolution education and human evolution education in particular.
Yeah, which was an absolutely phenomenal paper. And, you know, I use it all the time. But I'm just curious, what was it that got you, obviously working at Smithsonian, could get you interested in education and the communication aspect of your work, but also too, what was it that got you, because we haven't talked about this yet, and I know we will get into it, your efforts to work more with the religious community at large. So can you kind of talk about that and how you kind of got into that area?
Absolutely. So I got into evolution education research starting in about 2010 or 2011, a couple years after I started my permanent position, which was in 2008. I got invited to join a working group at a place called NESCENT, the National Evolutionary Synthesis Center, which was a center funded by National Science Foundation out of Duke University for about 10 years. And that center would bring together groups of people, working groups, for about 2 years. So the group would meet 4 or 5 times over the course of 2 years to kind of tackle an evolutionary problem. And they were meant to be interdisciplinary groups, and most of them were tackling science problems. But I got invited to one called Communicating the Relevance of Human Evolution. So it was an education group. And, and in that group, we started talking about the fact that there had been some research done at the college level about human evolution learning in the classroom, but there had been virtually none done at the high school level. And at the college level, there was research that said that students actually really like to learn about human evolution in their classrooms, particularly biology classrooms, and they can understand evolution related to humans because they can see diversity in humans better than they can see diversity in things like fruit flies, as one example. But this hadn't been done in high schools. And so I thought, well, it would be kind of interesting to just do a simple study, where you develop curriculum materials that use human examples to teach about evolution, and then also develop curriculum materials that don't use human examples and just see how the students, you know, do the human examples engage them more? Do they help them understand evolution better? So I started on this research trajectory. I thought, well, no, I don't have training or background in education research, but I know how to do research. And I partnered with several really good colleagues that are excellent evolution education researchers. And it was really, it was that part of that process in reading the literature and understanding that one of the big points of resistance to learning about evolution, engaging with the evidence, is religious faith for some people. Right. And not having been brought up in a religious faith where evolution was viewed as something, combative, this was new to me. So as I began reading more about it, I realized that it's really important to consider people's religious faith or be sensitive to particularly students' religious faith in the classroom if you want them to engage with the evidence for evolution. Now, that doesn't mean sort of teaching non-science things in science classrooms, but it means recognizing that, particularly in some communities, that having a discussion about what are scientific questions, what are non-scientific questions, and valuing questions that are non-scientific questions can be important to let the students kind of relax and say, okay, I'm not, you know, my teacher and scientists are not asking me to abandon my faith in order to learn about evolution. So that was one thing. And then the second one is that a few years after the Hall of Human Origins opened at the Natural History Museum, which occurred in 2010, we got funding for a traveling version of the exhibit to go to public libraries across the country. So between 2015 and 2017, a small traveling library exhibit went to 19 public libraries across the U.S. It stayed at each library for a month. And we specifically, as we worked with the American Library Association, who was our partner in this project, we were specifically interested in going to smaller communities for which they thought, you know, having a library exhibit about evolution might be difficult. And going to those communities and doing public programs, having community conversations, working with teachers in all of those communities, and having specific programs for religious leaders, you know, one thing I'm really interested in is how can we build bridges to make evolution less scary and threatening for people?
So what was your, if you don't mind me asking, what was your religious upbringing that didn't see any kind of conflict there?
Sure. So I was raised, I'm Jewish, and so I was raised in the synagogue we went to when I was growing up was conservative. I'm now a member of a Reform synagogue. But, you know, traditionally, Judaism does not, except for like other religious faiths, except for very conservative kind of flavors, you might say, doesn't tend to have a conflict with evolution because we generally don't have literal interpretations of biblical text. So that in my experience and understanding tends to be where the conflict comes in.
Okay. That's helpful. Thanks. Speaking of flavors, you mentioned briefly, or you're wondering where I'm going with this, right?
You mentioned eating a termite earlier.
Yeah, I did.
I am fascinated by, There's a fancy word for eating bugs, I'm sure, but I don't know what it is.
There is. I think it's called entomophagy, or I may not be pronouncing it correctly. Entomophagy.
Yes. Yeah. There you go. I'm seeing this more and more and more now with how many things you can eat that are made out of crickets and whatnot, because we know that how much of an impact meat and the meat industry is having on the climate and on the earth. And crickets are an amazing source of protein. And in places of the world where it's warmer all the time and the bugs are bigger, it's not seen as weird to eat bugs. Like, you know, you go to Mexico and you have a taco and you might have grasshoppers on it. And that's totally normal. But when I pull out my pumpkin spice crickets for my colleagues, it's like a gross out food. And like, they dare each other to eat the thing that I have in my desk for lunch. But in thinking about human as a species development, and you mentioned that meat is kind of, this is your, I was going to say meat is your bread and butter, but that's really mixing metaphors. Do you find any evidence for extensive, like, insect eating? I don't know how you would even find evidence of that. They don't leave bones.
So that's the issue. And actually, the person who has done the most research into this is Julie Lesnick at Wayne State University. And she has a recent book out called Edible Insects and Human Evolution that I would definitely recommend. It's very accessible. So you've hit on the exact problem, is that it is much harder to find evidence for insect eating in the past than it is to find evidence for butchery of animals, because animal bones fossilize. Some of the things that Julie looks for, or other folks who are interested in this, are there tools that have evidence of actually digging in termite mounds, is one example of an insect that early humans may have eaten. Are there actual preserved termite mounds in archaeological sites? But the evidence is harder to find, and I think people don't look for it as often. So I really enjoyed her book, and it convinced me that insects have probably been a much larger part of our diets in the past than we'll unfortunately probably ever be able to recognize.
They're a much better source of protein. I think locusts are like 60 or 70% protein cicadas are by protein by volume compared to meat. They just don't taste as yummy.
And they're, you know, insect raising is often very sustainable. It is much less, you know, you use much less resources like water and other things. And so I think it's a really good sort of alternative protein of the future.
Yeah. Well, do I have any on me right now? Oh, I don't.
More bugs.
Exo protein bars. Really the only ones you can get right now that have cricket protein in them, and just tons and tons of protein in those. I'll leave a link down there. I'm sure I have some affiliate link because I buy from them every month. So I get me some good cricket money.
So I'm curious if you wouldn't mind. I know. So I guess while I was at the Virginia Theological Seminary, there was a part of that time you went down to a different seminary, right, to do some work. Is that right?
Correct. Yes.
Can you kind of talk about that a little bit?
I can. So the traveling exhibit project, library project, which I mentioned, we had funding for 2 years from the Templeton Foundation, and that finished in 2017. But we've been in conversation among the Smithsonian team about potentially a new venue for our next round of travel, including seminaries. And so we've had kind of a pilot phase this year where that traveling exhibit has gone to 2 seminaries. The first is Payne Theological Seminary in Ohio, which is affiliated with the African Methodist Episcopal Church. And then the second is Columbia Theological Seminary in Georgia, which is a Presbyterian seminary. So that the Columbia was our second stop. And that's where I was while you were in Virginia. So that, and both of those visits were scheduled during basically so that the exhibit would be in the seminary for around the same time as a semester, so that faculty at the seminaries could incorporate some of the content into their classrooms, that there could be a few public programs if they were interested. We could do a workshop for Christian educators. So that's been a really wonderful experience, and we're hoping to take what we've learned from that and potentially apply for another round of funding, which might include both libraries and seminaries. So that's still kind of to be determined.
So even though you're this pilot, are you able to kind of get into more like any personal anecdotes or things that you have learned personally that could impact, you know, obviously you look at it professionally as a group, but how about you personally and you as a science communicator and science educator? What have you taken from those two experiences? We'll talk about the seminaries first, but then I do want to talk to you more about some of the library experiences.
Sure. So I mean, one of the things is that I think seminaries, this is obviously, you know, an N of two and some anecdotal conversations, but it seems like there is a growing awareness that and worry that younger folks are leaving the church because they are concerned about conflicts between religion and science. And so if seminary faculty can feel more comfortable talking about that issue, can feel more personally educated about evolution and human evolution, that could be a really positive outcome for seminary students who are then going off to be religious leaders and mm-hmm. may right now feel unequipped to, I mean, it's not obviously the top of most people's list of things that they're going to have to worry about as a religious leader, but it is something where I think there's concern among seminary educators about people going, well, you know, this is not even being addressed and it's something that I'm concerned about and I want to talk about it, and they may not feel prepared.
It's something I deal with all the time, and both as a pastor, that people come to me all the time and they ask me, they're not asking me, they're asking me to talk to their grandson or the granddaughter or their nephew or their cousin or somebody who won't come to church anymore because they believe in evolution, they don't believe in God. And they come to me because they know that I have some education in this and some knowledge of this. But I tried to push this on the seminary where I'm an adjunct. We applied for the Science and Seminaries grant. Unfortunately, didn't make the cut because I had a class that I'm developing that is exactly that, like a continuing education class that teaches pastors those basic elements of evolution and other hot button issues that helps them to communicate that.
I think that's fantastic. And, you know, from what we've heard from the seminaries that we've visited, and also Connie Bertka, who's a partner in this project, and in my my evolution education project, who teaches at Wesley Seminary, she adjuncts here in the DC area. You know, she teaches a class on science and religion, and occasionally either not enough students sign up, so her class ends up getting canceled, and she's been lobbying to make it part of the standard curriculum, but it never quite makes it in there. And I think, you know, I think it's really concerning the messages coming from either, you know, like scientists or religious leaders saying, well, if you accept evolution, you can't have religion anymore and don't come to church. That's not good for anybody. Absolutely. So, you know, I think it's important to have voices from all communities, from the scientific community, from the religious community saying, nah, that's, you don't have to make that choice.
Yeah. So, you know, it's funny that when we talk about evolution, generally we can find some middle ground. We're talking about primordial ooze and dinosaurs into chickens and whatnot. But when we get into this issue of human evolution, that's when we really have this conflict, because when we start talking about our ancestors and how human are they, and wait a second, is there like a moralistic Adam and Eve who sinned, and then what do we do with the doctrine of original sin, and what do we do with the Bible and all of that nonsense. Did Lucy have a soul? You know, and
one of my you know, great evolution education colleagues, Bill Watson, who used to work at the Smithsonian and now works in a school district in New Jersey and is one of my key collaborators. He says, you know, one of the questions that keeps him up at night is, did Neanderthals go to heaven? You know, I don't know how you can answer those questions, but I actually think it's really good to ask them.
Yeah. Absolutely. What do you do with like evidence of Neanderthal art or jewelry that they have some concept of something abstract? And if they have abstract thinking and their brains are bigger than Homo sapiens, then and if there's interbreeding between all the different early hominids, and you know, what if
Neanderthals buried their dead? Did they have a concept of an afterlife? We don't know. We might never. But are all the other species in some way less human than us? And if so, what does that mean? And how do you define human anyway?
That sounds like an amazing idea for the next episode. Those of you listening at home, make sure you listen next week. We may or may not have already recorded that.
The magic.
They did not plant that, I promise.
But maybe you could help us out a little bit more, because I love talking about that. But I'm woefully ignorant about the actual nuts and bolts of when we became human, and if we can say that, and what kind of evidence that we have. I know the beginning evidence of all of the Denisovans was just a sliver of a pinky finger of a little kid. And how can we... I don't even know the right question to ask you about us, but this is your job, so maybe you know.
So one question that I'd like, so if we're talking about humans as in our species, as in Homo sapiens, well, let me back up before I get to Homo sapiens and say part of the cool thing about human evolution is that the qualities that make us human accumulated over a long period of time. They didn't all just appear with one species. So we walk upright on two legs. We're the only, you know, primate or mammal that does that on a regular basis. That evolved probably somewhere between 6 and 7 million years ago. We have really huge brains for our body size. That started evolving 1 million years ago. The sophisticated language, communication, symbolism, that probably came later in time. So it's not that with the evolution of our species, all of a sudden, all of these traits occurred at once. It was a process. But the evidence for the evolution of our species, of Homo sapiens, right now, the earliest fossil evidence goes back to about 300,000 years. And the genetic evidence also points back to around between 2 and 300,000 years, that the separation between modern humans and our closest extinct relatives, including Neanderthals and Denisovans, who you've mentioned, that separation probably started about 500,000 years ago, but kind of finished by between 200,000 and 300,000 years ago. Finished, except that, as you mentioned, there was interbreeding between modern humans and Neanderthals and Denisovans. And that is because we came into contact with each other. Obviously, we had overlapping ranges, and we were close enough that we recognized each other as mates. So it's tough because speciation is a process; it's not an event, and that can be kind of hard to say. Well, where do you draw the line? I mean, this is a question that modern biologists ask all the time. With living species, we have a fossil record of, you know, just a fraction of all the individuals who lived in the past, and it makes it that much harder. This is why I actually don't study the human fossil record, because it kind of makes me want to throw up my hands and go, well, I don't know. You know, you could draw the line here and you could draw the line here, and how much variation is within a species. And it's these questions that kind of make my head spin. I think they're really important to ask. And I think that the more evidence we find, the more secure we can be in our interpretations.
Again, I'm just always amazed whenever we talk about this stuff, because it's just so cool. Can you talk more, unless Zach, you have another question related to that?
I am curious to know, nuts and bolts wise, you mentioned that our DNA evidence goes back 300,000 years, I think is what you said. How do we know that?
Yeah, so actually it goes back further than that. So it goes back about 400,000 years. And so we can actually, not we, because it's not research that I do, but you know, paleoanthropologists can actually extract DNA from fossilized bones, usually in places where the fossils have been buried under like cold, arid conditions, because like moisture and heat are not good for DNA preservation. So DNA preservation in the tropics doesn't go back nearly that far. But, you know, you can get proteins and DNA and other genetic material back like millions of years. So unfortunately, most of our evolution did happen in tropical areas. So, you know, if I had like my top 10 wish list of things that I would want evidence wise from human evolution, I want some DNA from Homo erectus. I don't think I'm ever going to get any. But the more genetic evidence we have, the more complicated the picture becomes, which is not surprising. Again, because it takes a long time for species to become isolated so that they do not or will not or cannot interbreed with each other. And yeah, the discovery of Denisovans was a great story. So this is a species, well, it's not called a species yet. It's a population called the Denisovans. And there's a cave in Siberia called Denisova Cave, and part of the Neanderthal Genome Project, which was established in the early 2000s, was extracting DNA from lots of Neanderthal fossils. And so Denisova Cave has both Neanderthals and modern human fossils found in it. So that group was doing extraction of DNA from what they thought were Neanderthal bones from Denisova Cave. And then they got a DNA sequence that was not modern human and was not Neanderthal. And so that was the beginning of the recognition of this other population called Denisovans that left its genetic echoes in modern humans all the way from Siberia to Papua New Guinea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you mentioned Homo erectus. Is that our direct ancestor?
So that's kind of our like grandparent ancestor. So I think the going idea right now is that we evolved from a species called Homo heidelbergensis, mm-hmm. which is found in Europe and Africa.
So around Heidelberg.
Yeah, yeah. So the first, you know, early fossils were found in Heidelberg, Germany. And the population,
where I was born. I just want to throw that in there. Go ahead.
Excellent. Very important place in human evolutionary history.
Yes.
And so Homo heidelbergensis populations in Africa most likely evolved into our species, Homo sapiens, and the populations in Europe most likely evolved into Neanderthals. But probably the direct ancestor of Homo heidelbergensis is Homo erectus. So they are kind of a once removed or, you know, grandparent ancestor.
Because they left Africa earlier, right? Like they walked across across Asia and...
That's right. So the earliest fossils of any early human species or hominin species to leave Africa are fossils of Homo erectus. Correct.
Okay.
Just making sure I got my family tree together.
Yeah. And, you know, we change it on you every once in a while. But kind of, I think, you know, the main, we add a branch here and there. But the main shape of the human family tree, I think, is actually fairly well agreed on.
Hmm. I think I was reading before that that Homo heidelbergensis was right-handed because of fossil records of uneven wear on teeth.
So I've heard that for Neanderthals, and so Neanderthals really use their teeth like tools, or they sort of use their mouth like vices, and the idea is that they would hold an animal skin or something they were processing in their teeth and then hold it in their hand and do a lot of scraping and things like that. And so they do. They have uneven wear on their teeth. So
I love the fact that we can make inferences based on something like that.
Me too. It's amazing, like, you know, little bits of evidence. I mean, I love... You know, paleoanthropology is such an interdisciplinary science, and there are all different kinds of lines of evidence that we use, and it's really fun.
Right? I feel like you are the paleo version of Benedict Cumberbatch's Sherlock.
I think that's fantastic.
So how has it been? Because, you know, one of the stories you sent us, I forgot what source it was, but it was about the traveling exhibit.
Yeah.
And it was talking about a particular place in Pennsylvania, I guess it was.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Pennsylvania. That's right.
Yeah. And so we could talk a little bit about that one, you know, but I'm curious, what has your experience been like at various locations when talking into these communities that tend to be a little bit not, I don't know if hostile is the right word, but at least guarded or frustrated by evolution, the teaching of evolution? How has that gone for you and what have you learned from it?
Yeah, it's interesting. So as I mentioned, the exhibit went to 19 libraries across the U.S., small communities, large communities, rural, urban, kind of a nice diversity. And at every place we did a community conversation in the library, kind of like a town hall meeting. And most of them, the majority of them were very respectful, very engaging conversations. There were some real amazing heartfelt, you know, I might call them testimonies of people saying like, I grew up in the church and then I learned about evolution and I was really conflicted or, you know, and I'm still wrestling with this. And or there was a family in one of the places that we visited where it was parents of maybe a middle schooler and a high schooler, if I remember correctly. And they were homeschooling their kids and they came and we had a wonderful conversation with the family that basically said, we're really interested in science, but we totally don't accept evolution. It's a historical science. It doesn't work the same way. You don't mm-hmm. have the same kinds of evidence. And, you know, as a science communicator, my goals are really dependent on the situation. I don't walk into, you know, a community conversation in a library in a place where I don't live and expect to like everybody to walk out the door convinced of the veracity of evolution. Mm-hmm. My goals, especially for engaging with people in communities where there can be some real trepidation about evolution, is to, my goals include having a respectful conversation, having people feel heard and listened to, genuinely understanding where the points of like, you know, where the sticky points are, and having them not think that scientists are jerks and out to target their faith. Because, mm-hmm. you know, some are. I try not to be, but I think that, you know, and, you know, some people are told, well, the, you know, the reason like that scientists study evolution is deliberately to make people not believe in God. And I don't know any scientist who does that, but I think the, you know, the goals for these conversations were for the people in those communities to say like, the Smithsonian is coming to visit because we want to hear what you think. We want to hear what the concerns are. And I was amazed at things that perfect strangers were willing to share with each other and us in these library conversations. So part of it is, I think, you know, trying to make a safe space to have these conversations, because a lot of people said, this is of concern to me and I don't know where I can go to talk about it.
Right. Do you remember at all about how it went with that family that talked about, you know, because you used the phrasing historical science.
Yes, which is the phrase that they used. Exactly.
And so, you know, a lot of that comes from people like Ken Ham and Answers in Genesis. And I know it precedes him, but he's a big proponent of that. And so I'm just curious, can you kind of, if you can remember any of the specifics about how that conversation went?
Yes. So I remember a lot. Actually, it made a big impression on me. So I remember that the mom in that family, by the end of that conversation, a lot of it was like, you could see real genuine struggle of, I'm interested in this. I'm scared of it. And one of the things I like most about the outcome of that conversation is that there was a pastor there from another church, not the one that they went to. But that pastor and that family, after the library closed, when our program was over, stood outside talking on the sidewalk for at least half an hour. And so, you know, I don't think at all the family came there to yell at us or, I think it was there are talking points that they had read or they had heard about of, you know, here, you know, what the roadblocks are. But I think there was real, like, genuine interest. And I think as long as there's a little glimmer of real interest, if there's a little, you know, prospect of making some kind of connection, I think as long as we can do that and move the conversation along a little bit in the right direction, But yeah, I mean, the idea of like, well, nobody saw it. The historical science kind of, you know, criticisms, no one saw it. You can't prove it. So I think, you know, some of those typical issues with the idea of evolution were talked about.
Was that when you came out to Ephrata?
No, that was actually in Florida, in Orlando.
Because there was like some local boycott, right, here?
There was. Correct. And so in Ephrata, the exhibit was in Ephrata, Pennsylvania in July. And the homeschool community uses the library extensively, apparently, and decided to boycott the library for the entirety of the month that the exhibit was in Ephrata. The librarian there, Penny Talbert, is a wonderful woman and very brave. And she comes from, I believe, an Amish background from, and there's there's a pretty significant Amish population in the area. So she, but she has a really good relationship. She's not Amish anymore, but she has a great relationship with the community. And even though there was a boycott of the exhibit by some folks in the community, the library also had record high visitation of 30,000 people during that month.
Whoa.
So, yes, exactly.
And I know most of our listeners have never been to Ephrata, but that's huge. Wow, I wish I'd have known it was there then. I'm not too far from there.
Oh, that's too bad. Yeah, it was really, and I was not able to go, but at least the year after, and apparently the plan was for every year after the exhibit left, is that there was a basically a community event where people broke bread and ate food together that was up, like, was going to have some theme about human evolution or human origins every year. And so I hope that's persisted. I'm not sure.
I like how you said that before I had you go into detail about the experience you have with the family in Florida, the way you approach it and recognizing that you have to deal with the environment you're in to not, it sounds like you're recognizing the importance of not going in there saying, I am the expert, listen to me.
I think that's really important. It's really off-putting, I think, for particularly in some, you know, smaller communities and where, well, the, you know, these people from the North and the Smithsonian are going to come and tell, you know, they don't know our community, and it's not respectful. So I do, I really think, I mean, one of the first most important principles of science communication is to know your audience. Right. Who are you talking to, and, you know, what are their values? And even though you can't actually physically get to know people beforehand, get a sense of, you know, what you're walking into. I think that's really important.
Yeah. Interesting. So what do you, go ahead.
I was going to say that we have like maybe 10 minutes left. And so as we begin to wrap this up, is there anything that in your field you want to dispel? If I give you a soapbox to say,
yeah, here,
man,
you go,
I
Brianna,
really wish people would just understand this one thing.
All the things. No.
All the things.
So I guess I would say it depends on who I'm talking to, I guess. I mean, I really wish, you know, people would understand that not specific to human evolution in general, but that science is about discoveries building on other discoveries. And the reason that there are still unanswered questions, or the reasons that our conclusions can change, is because of the very nature of science. It doesn't mean that science is uncertain. It doesn't mean that scientists don't know what they're doing. It doesn't mean that the fossil find that somebody makes next week or next year is going to overturn everything we thought we knew about human evolution. So, I mean, if anything, I would say the sensational headlines should be taken with a grain of salt. The scientists don't write those headlines. And actually, a lot of the science journalists don't write those headlines either. They have like headline writers, apparently, that write those. And so I think that scientists are a community of skeptics, and that we are trying really hard to put forward the best evidence on hypotheses that we can. Yeah. And that, you know, we're not, most of us, like, we're not in it for the money and the fame and the fortune, because there's really not much of that. We're in it because we're really passionate and really interested in what we do. And these questions are what drive us. And we're so interested in exploring the natural world. For me, like, the mysteries that the past holds are so intriguing. And every time we can, you know, uncover evidence or come, like, make a conclusion that lets us learn a little more about the collective ancestry of all people, that's awesome.
Yeah, that's one of the coolest things in the entire world. I'm so jazzed right now.
So what do you hope to do, not necessarily with Smithsonian, but, like, with the science communication in your outreach work that you're trying to do in different communities? What are your next steps? And then also, like, your pie in the sky goals?
Yeah, I mean, so next steps, right now I'm on my second big evolution education project in schools, which is focused entirely in Alabama. And we're doing some research looking at the use of human examples in high school biology classrooms. So if we get the pilot results from that project are really promising. And if we find that human evolution really jazzes kids the way that we think it will, you know, my pie in the sky, like, I think that human evolution should be taught in every classroom in the United States. I would love that, because yes, it may be a high bar for kids, but it's also such an easy entry into understanding, you know, basic evolutionary principles. And maybe that would also lead to a shift in understanding of evolution, maybe eventually acceptance of evolution, and, you know, fear of scientists and experts and all these other things that I think are kind of plaguing the scientific community right now.
Right.
Maybe if we all understood human evolution a little bit better, we'd realize that we're really not that different. Maybe we would like each other a little bit more and stop killing each other as much.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, the message
stop talking of silly.
The message of our shared deep, like, humanity, I think, is so, so important with the divisiveness in current society. And human evolution scientists can send that message. There is such a longer scale on which we've been so similar than the short scale on which our outward differences have evolved. And humans genetically are so similar to each other, it's actually scary.
Yeah. If Homo sapiens and Denisovans can get together, then why can't we?
That's right. Exactly. Exactly.
This has been episode 20 of the Down the Wormhole podcast. Ugh, it feels so good to be back. If you've enjoyed the show, would you do me a quick favor and just share your favorite episode on social media? You know, all the ads and algorithms of the world are still not as powerful as a simple suggestion from a friend. You can find contact information, show notes, and more at downthewormhole.com. Join us next week as we discuss whether or not Neanderthals had spiritual lives and how much we should read into 30,000-year-old idols and cave paintings. Are they like Stone Age cathedrals or just pretty pictures? Is God a later invention, or have we always been in touch with the spiritual? No spoilers. You're going to have to wait until next Wednesday. In the meantime, Brianna, take us out with your favorite bridge.
And I think my favorite bridge is the Tappan Zee Bridge, which goes across the Hudson River, because it's the closest bridge to where I grew up in New York.